Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for those 5-star reviews on iTunes. Keep them coming. And thank you guys for following that YouTube channel.
Yeah, everybody, thank you. Really appreciate the 5-star reviews. If it's your first time listening, please, after you're done listening to us, however you found us, we're really excited. After that, please go ahead and subscribe to us on YouTube, follow us on Instagram, subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use.
Yeah, and I got to give a huge, we have to give a huge thank you to all of our new supporters. Thank you guys for signing up. Thanks for supporting the podcast. It's really helping us get what we need to get to take some of these shows live. We've got two legitimate live shows in front of an audience lined up, and a couple that we're just going to record live, because our guests don't like to talk in front of people, but they're more than willing to have them go out in the
airwaves.
They're
willing to be on camera.
Right? And a huge thanks to the Always Ready Collective for their support. It's been phenomenal lately.
Absolutely. They're doing a great job for us.
And who we've got today. So this one's cool. Bill and I have talked to him. I love what he's doing now to volunteer, especially, after his service.
Yeah.
But his service is unreal.
I'm a little jealous.
I am beyond jealous. And we're going to change the format a little bit today, and we're actually going to talk more about the progression of the career in the Coast Guard, and obviously some dangerous and daring, but we are going to talk about how this went down. It's pretty good. Who we got on the phone? Former Bosun Mate Third Class Doug Johnson. I would start, where his career began. He basically graduated high school back in 75, graduated on a Friday, and then on Sunday boarded the bus for Alameda, California, and went to boot camp, graduating on June 6, 1975, with recruit company Charlie 101. And from there, things got – he could basically write a travelogue
things
for careers.
Awesome.
Yeah, things got awesome. Yeah. So, hey, Doug, welcome to the show, and how are you?
Thanks, guys. Doing really good and just real happy to be here.
Awesome. So tell us what happened after that June 6th day in 1975 – where did you head to from base Alameda, or from recruit training in Alameda?
Well, from recruit training, I went to base Honolulu, where I was awaiting further assignment. At the time, you had to have 4 months' time in service before you could be sent overseas.
I was going to say, what is a non-rate at the time doing base Honolulu in 1975? Is there a lot of surf? Did you learn to surf while you were there?
And taking even further back, where were you from originally?
I was from Northern California. I grew up near Redding, California.
Okay. So you had some beaches, but they were cold.
Right.
Well, it was a ways to the beach, but yeah, we used to go regular. And, I always loved the ocean from a very young age and wanted to know what was on the other side. So I was kind of born to be a sailor.
And then they said, you're going to Hano. And they told you when you graduated, right? I'm assuming, right before you graduated recruit training?
Yes. Yeah. We got our assignments then.
Did you have to fight anybody for it, or did it just happen?
It just happened.
All right. So you're in Hano.
Yep.
How's Hano?
It was really interesting. Went there the first time I flew in a C-130. It was an 8.5 hour flight from Travis. It was my first long flight in an airplane, and went there to Hawaii, and my first time out in the Pacific. It was just amazing. And the duty, we were basically doing maintenance stuff. We have a little humor about it now. We found out pretty quick. They'd sent us out with weed whackers clearing the buoy yard where they stored buoys. And we figured out to get a couple of coconuts from the garden boys there and go out and lay in the shade at the buoys and make the day go by pretty good.
That's exactly how I picture Hawaii.
This is what I was hoping to hear.
Right.
So, we had galley. They'd put us on galley duty, and we did that. But it was just a couple months, and then we went off to Tokyo.
All right. Well, there's our lead-in. So from... yep. You finish your 4 months, you're assigned to the Far East section, which I mean, I've read about. I don't know if that's around anymore or not. So how long are you in Tokyo?
I was just there for a couple of days, and they flew me out to Marcus Island.
This is what I want to hear about.
This Tell sounds us about like a pile of sand in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, what is Marcus Island? Where is it, and what's it look like?
Marcus Island is a little triangular-shaped coral atoll. On the longest side of the triangle is a runway that's just long enough for a fully loaded C-130 to land. Big tower in the middle of the island. We were 1,300 miles due south of Tokyo. I believe the nearest land was Wake Island at 900 miles away. So this is very isolated.
Yeah. Is there any
Now, these days, everybody's all connected on computer, and they Skype and all that. Back then, when atmospheric conditions were just right, we could sometimes pick up Armed Forces radio from Japan. And we got one phone call a week over the radio telephone where you got 5 or 10 minutes to speak with your family. And that was our only contact with the outside world.
And you were at a Loran station, right?
Yes, it was a Loran C station.
So describe, for anybody that doesn't know or doesn't remember Loran, describe what it does for us.
Well, Loran is basically long-range aids to navigation is what it is. And it was a system that not only all United States ships, but all ships of all countries all over the world use to navigate the seas.
Like triangulated position, right? You get a few radio, or I guess
they send out a radio pulse from different stations, and then they would measure the time delay on the pulse, and that would give you a position.
There's some article about it, about when Loran was developed in World War II. It was super secret technology, trying to hide it from the Nazis.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it's very cool how it developed.
Yeah, that's when the Loran started was in World War II.
Yeah.
And I believe it went on up through the early 90s.
Yeah, I'd say even into the
2000s. I think it was
into
the 2000s until they finally shut, because I graduated boot camp in 04, and we had a guy get assigned to St. Paul Island, Alaska, for a Loran station.
And go ahead and just tell us again, Bill, what's in your wallet?
Yeah, I got rid of it. I got a new wallet.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's in my house.
Oh, man.
When I went to BMA school, I had to learn how to plot on the Loran C, even though it was going away, and I joked with Phil, I kept the interpolator in my wallet for like 15 years.
I used to have one of those.
That just tells you how often I clean out my wallet.
Yeah.
So, Doug, you're on Marcus Island. Like you said, radio tower, she's triangular shaped, 900 miles from the nearest point of land. How many guys are there? What do you guys do all day?
Are there any native inhabitants? Like, do we at least have like
no native inhabitants? Unfortunately, no, though they had that at some, I understand Yap was one of the most fantastic places to be, but no, this was real isolated. There were 30 Coast Guard and 30 Japanese. They had a weather station and a Japanese defense group there. And so there was about 60 of us all together.
And
basically walk around the island in, you know, in 45 minutes or an hour.
And what did you guys do all day? I mean, what was, I guess, number one, what was the mission?
It was just basically was maintaining the place is what we did. And frankly, it could have been run with a lot less people, but some people did not handle the isolation very well.
You had to plan for attrition?
Yes, exactly, for attrition. And they found that, you know, frankly, it kept that down and kept the suicide rate down.
Okay, so it was seriously couldn't handle it. Yeah,
right.
I understand.
Yeah, some people, unfortunately, just seriously could not handle it. It was...
Well, it's almost like being...
You know, for me as a kid just coming out of high school, this was pretty major culture shock. But, you know, well, what we did is, you know, first we had sports. We played softball out on the runway, and we played volleyball. Until I was at Marcus Island, I did not know that volleyball was a full contact sport. They had what they called jungle rules. But we did that, and what I remember most, enjoyed the most, was we did a lot of diving. We were just supposed to snorkel inside the reef, really, but I guess I can say now, because all these years it's closed, we had a bunker that was left over from World War II. Had been wired up with electricity, and we had a dive compressor. And that's where I learned to scuba dive.
Wow, what an old guard story. Yeah, like, that's awesome.
It was just fantastic, you know, to dive out there. The visibility was so great. It was a breeding ground for gray reef sharks, so we saw sharks every time we got in the water, basically. We used to dive in basically groups of three. And when you saw sharks, you just go back to back. We'd carry little shark billies. It's just a little piece of conduit, basically, with a handle on one end and a lanyard on your wrist and that. And if they came in real close, you use it to push them back out of the way, because mostly they're just curious.
I totally thought you were going to say you just ripped the regulator out of the other guy's mouth and start swimming.
Yeah. Well, that might not be a good thing to do. They're curious, but that might... get some different behavior.
Right.
You know, I learned a lot about the sharks out there. They're real territorial. And when they're in their little spot, they're dangerous. They kind of drop their head down, kind of hunches down, and their tail starts going back and forth real quick. But when they're not in their little spot, they're mostly just curious. And I've heard they've done research since, and they say maybe it's the reflection off your dive masks that keep them back or whatever, but we never had any problem with sharks. You know, we didn't, I'd say we just carried little billies. There were no bang sticks or anything like that. We didn't go out and try and kill sharks. We fished for them sometimes, but we were real cautious, and like I say, we saw sharks every time we got in the water.
How was the fishing out there?
It was just very good.
Yeah.
I imagine phenomenal
spread. What I remember a lot is lobster. It was the first time I got so much lobster in my life. And we used to dive in, when we were diving inside the reef, along the reef, we'd pick lobster out of there. An old Hawaiian contractor that was down there taught us how to tell whether an eel is in the hole with the lobster or not, because you don't really want to grab in there and get eels.
I can honestly say I've never pulled a lobster out with an eel like behind it, but yeah, I can imagine that one. You know, that's dangerous, man.
That's the kind of noodling you don't want to do.
Yeah, right? Sure. You know, when you're on watch or you're eating lobster, that's dangerous, man, because that stuff's like turkey. If you're like...
Do you mean?
If you eat lobster, and you know, like turkey Thanksgiving...
Makes
like
you tired.
Yeah, it's the same thing, man. Lobster will, like, put you down.
I've never had that happen to me.
Yes, it will.
I've almost passed out. Like,
I guess I haven't eaten enough lobster.
Yeah, it's you eat enough, man, it'll put you down.
That's crazy. Is there any wildlife on the island? Like, is it just birds? I'm assuming there's at least birds. Is there anything?
Birds.
Nothing but birds?
Nothing but birds. Well, there were a bunch of rats down at the dump. But
of course there were.
Of course that. But otherwise, it was, you know, actually what Marcus Island is, Minami Torishima, which means South Bird Island in Japanese. It's what it is. It's actually a suburb of Tokyo. But it is.
It's a suburb of Tokyo, 1,300 miles away. That's awesome.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the island covered in bird poop? I don't know. I'm just very interested in the South Pacific island that we got.
There was for sale. That's the real question.
No, it's basically all coral. There's really no dirt or anything, but I've seen in some later pictures, I don't know if they flew some in, but there was a lot of stuff planted around the swimming pool that wasn't there when I was there. We had a saltwater swimming pool.
Because that's what it was, more water.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, we'd go, you know, there was a dry season, we'd go on water rationing, and, you know, you got a coffee can of water to get wet with and soap up, and a coffee can of water to rinse and with. And that was a couple times a week.
That sounds miserable.
How often was the resupply?
All the salt water, you had all the salt water you wanted.
Right.
Yeah, right. How often was the resupply? They just flew in, what, like weekly or something, or...
Yes, the Air Force used to come in weekly, or most times.
Yeah. Well, what happened when they didn't come in? Did it just turn into, like, Lord of the Flies?
That's what I was going
to... No, it didn't. It didn't get too bad. They missed a few flights, and I think the word went back to Japan that they needed to fix things up, and they sent us an extra pallet of beer and a foosball machine that we'd been waiting for a long time, and, you know, there wasn't a lot they could do for morale out on these places. You know, it was feed is good, and of course, like I said, we got our beer ration.
A different Coast Guard.
Yeah.
Who was in charge of the station?
We had a Lieutenant JG was in charge.
Okay. And then, like, what was the kind of the enlisted breakdown? Was it one officer and a bunch of enlisted, or how did?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what did?
We had a chief bosun out there and a damage controlman. Chief and a chief MK and some firemen and basically a big group of ETs, electronic technicians.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who stood watches. The rest of us, we were maintenance. We didn't stand watches.
Yeah.
Right.
And was there a benefit to going there? Like I'm sure they talked about that back then. We call it priority now. Like if somebody takes an isolated unit, an underway unit, they get priority for their next assignment. Was this the same back then?
No.
No.
No, I don't believe
there,
so.
There was no such thing as needs of the member in the 70s.
But there was young seaman Doug Johnson, who, following his tour, or, you know, is even less than, he didn't even do the full tour on Marcus Island. Tell us where he went after that.
After that, I was sent to the Marine Safety Office in Guam. They just had a big typhoon in Guam, Typhoon Pamela, if I remember correctly, and it really torn the place up, and I was sent to a 10-person Marine Safety Office where we had a little 30-footer, and we rebuilt the station there, and I made grade. I made bosun mate third class there, and I also certified as a small boat search and rescue coxswain, which, you know, with all the things I've done in my life, is probably one of the proudest things I've ever done. I was 19.
Heck,
that's awesome.
Now, you said a few things there that we just got to talk about. Number one, typhoon came through in Guam. You said rebuilt the station. I mean, was it devastating to the island? Is it? Did they prep you for what you were walking into?
There were parts of the island that didn't even have power back for 7.5 months.
Oh, wow.
Part of it was there was bad things going on in Guam back then, but there were people pulling down the wires at night that they were stringing during the day and melting them down and selling them, and Guam was just not a good place. There were a lot of drugs and things down there at the time, and the whole place was just very, very devastated.
Yeah.
So when you say you rebuilt the station, like, that was literally you guys out there putting stuff back together?
Yeah, when I got there, we built a new dock for our 30-footer. It was there. I don't know how it had survived, because I got there, you know, like a week after the typhoon. But we built a new dock. I actually supplied us from the Navy ship repair facility there. I got all the angle iron to build a dock and the planks for it and the barrels to float it. You know, we all look the same. We drove gray government trucks, you know, and we're wearing blue dungarees. So I had pretty good success until I was driving out with an aluminum gangway. But I just told them I was taking it over for the Admiral's barge, and they waved me through. And
what an awesome!
I want to be in the 70s
like Coast Guard, right? Yeah, was, like I just threw them.
You know, well, we were the poor sister of all the services, you know, and we were still working with World War II equipment, and yeah.
That's awesome.
You're never stealing from another service. No, you're just appropriating.
You're reappropriating previously appropriated items.
Right. Exactly.
We refer to it as cumshaw.
I love it.
That's perfect. Awesome, though. But I'm just like imagining, like, this is like something out of a like Hollywood movie, like World War II movie or something. There was that one guy who you just went, I don't care how you get it, just get it.
Yeah.
And here's Seaman Johnson just driving the Chevy over to the Navy base, loading stuff up and leaving, and nobody asks a question.
Just lets it go.
Well, you know, they used to call us the Hooligans Navy, so.
I read a thing about that, the first Northwest Passage where we went across the top of Canada mm-hmm. and went around. It was the Coast Guard led the way, of course, but the Navy had to tag along, right? And the Navy Admiral's meeting with all the Coast Guard commanders, and he called them the Hooligan Navy, and the Coast Guard commander looked at him and said, I have no trouble with you calling us hooligans, but I'm offended by the Navy part of that statement.
Nice.
I love that.
That's good.
I paraphrased there.
That was good, though.
Quote,
yeah, that was it. So back in the 70s, Doug, what did you have to do to become a bosun mate?
Well, there was no A school for it back then. You basically, you would strike for bosun mate, and you had to take a service-wide exam for it.
And then what did you have, like, what tasks did they make you do? What was the, I'm just curious, like, you know, a few decades ago, what was the process? I get you had to take the tests and stuff, but what did you actually have to do?
Well, you'd have to have, like, a chief bosun mate to certify you. And things, and you had to know, you know, knotting and splicing, you know,
three strand and double braided, or
three strand. You didn't have to do double braided, although I can splice just about anything, but no, just eye splice, back splice, and long splice, and three strand.
Did you have to build the bosun chair?
No.
No.
Wow.
Where did that come in?
Well, I used one a lot, but yeah.
I'm sorry. So what else? So we got splicing. We've got, I think
so
it's like a NAF.
Deck seamanship stuff. You had to
actually
be useful.
Yeah, like a useful user. I just figured, I didn't know if they were like, well, Doug, you build a dock and you got all the equipment to do it. So I'm gonna be in three.
Oh yeah, no, there was a lot of seamanship involved, and like I say, it was all on the job training.
Yeah.
Bosun mate second class there in Guam.
Did you have to make coxswain before you made bosun mate?
No. Actually, I don't remember now. It's been so long ago.
Yeah.
I don't know which came first.
All right. Well, tell us about the 30-footer and how you got your coxswain letter on her. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Well, we had an old 30-footer, just a little single screw boat, nothing like the boats they have these days. We had a compass and a VHF radio, that was our nav.
All you need.
Maybe a chart.
That was all we needed, yeah.
Pheathometer, maybe.
Yeah.
No, we didn't have a pheathometer.
Did you have a lead line?
That would have been nice. That would have been handy. We had to learn the charts pretty well.
So how fast does this thing go, Doug?
Just maybe 12 knots or so. It wasn't real fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the minimum crew on it? Did you have to take out, like, at least two people or something every time you went?
Two.
Yeah. And then what missions did you guys do on the at the MSO underway?
Basically, we patrolled the harbor, and we did a little bit of search and rescue, though not much of that. A lot of it was just being a presence there in the harbor, I guess.
Yeah.
Showing the flag, huh?
Showing the flag, yep.
What was your first case?
I don't remember.
Can you remember any of them?
I don't really remember any from Guam.
Yeah. Okay. Right. We'll get to the next one. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you've been at Guam for, I don't know, how long were you there before they sent you to the next spot?
I think I was again there for maybe 8 or 9 months.
Yeah.
And then I was transferred on basically 24 hours notice to back to base Honolulu in Oahu, Hawaii.
Back to surfing.
We're starting moving back east. Right. So what? Why did they send you so fast?
I don't know. I guess they never just told me. It was as the needs of the service dictate. But
that's just how it was done in those days. Like everybody kind of just found out real quick.
No, not everybody. I don't know why I was special.
Well,
is that how they
usually people you know would serve full tours? That's the deal. I served a couple of short tours, and I don't know why they just. They said, hey, we want you to go here, and I did. That's, you know what I did. I signed a blank check to Uncle Sam. So.
Somebody probably looked at it and went, well, we sent him to Hano, Tokyo, Guam. He's going back to Hano. He doesn't get to complain.
Right. And then what did you do at in Hano, Doug?
Well, I went to Honolulu as I was a bosun mate third class, and I was a search and rescue coxswain. That's where I immediately went to the boathouse. There and started and you know started training on a new boat. We had one of the new 41 footers then. They were just real new to the service and you know the latest in technology. We were real proud of them. I had the 41317.
Everybody remembers their first boat without fail.
And it was great. I worked with we basically had a three-man crew. Have an engineer and a deckhand and the coxswain. I worked with some really great people there. I was there, I don't think, much more than about a month, and they sent me to Petaluma, California, for a pilot program in emergency medical technician training. They decided to start training the coxswains as EMTs. And it was a real intensive two-week course. That we went through and certified as EMTs. I did that, went back to Honolulu, was there for a year or so, I guess, and they needed a coxswain in Kauai. We traded as a four-man station.
Four-man station in Kauai. Poor man.
I know, man. Like, anybody else would be like, yeah, they needed a coxswain in Duluth. Somewhere terrible.
Venice.
Right.
Well, the funny thing is, I always wanted to serve on an icebreaker. And I'd put in for that, but I guess once I was in the 14th district, that's where I was going to be.
Yeah. Doug, everyone listening to this right now just has no pity.
There's a bunch of guys on icebreakers right now going, no.
Yeah, you're fine.
I imagine there are.
So what about, how's Kauai compared to Hano?
Kauai was just beautiful. Like I said, it was a little, it was a four-man station. Honolulu was, it was a big base for the Coast Guard. Maybe 150 to 170 people plus several ships stationed there, the two 378s and a 180-foot buoy tender. The Jarvis and the Mellon were there. So then going to this little tiny station, and what was left, there was also a Loran A station on Kauai, and I had maybe 15 or 20 people there, so it was a group, but where we were, it was just the four of us. We're a little boathouse there out on a jetty. I looked on Google Maps the other day, and I think I see the outlines of the foundation and where our dock was, but most of the jetty that was out there is all gone now. I don't know if it went in a typhoon, but there was a little place beyond us, the club jetty, which was a real active place, a little bar and restaurant. And then past it was the hydrofoil dock where the hydrofoils that ran Inner Island used to come in. And all that's gone now. It looks like there's just a parking lot for cruise ships now. And the Coast Guard station is actually up at the small boat harbor in the Willy Willy.
I'm just thinking about, but, like, man, how much I would like to be there
in,
right now.
In Kauai. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
In a four-man station.
It was just wonderful duty. It was a four-man station. You know, I had to carry a beeper with me. I was on recall all the time because I was the only
talk
person.
About high technology.
Yeah, that,
you guys had beepers back then,
right?
I'm not trying to sound smart alecky, but I'm actually, I didn't know they existed that long ago.
They were just brand new, to be honest.
And then you had to what, like find a payphone and then call back to the station?
Yep, find a payphone and call in. Yep.
They give you a pocket full of change too, or is that like members?
No, take a collect call.
Just had to have that.
Yeah, you just had to have it. Came out of the check.
That's
well,
awesome.
Tell us about a few. Do you remember any cases from Hano or Kauai?
I remember a few. You know, like I said, we went out in some pretty bad weather and different things. And all I can say is bravo Zulu to my crews. You know, we went out and we just did our jobs. Nobody earned any medals. We, you know, we did what we did. We put out some fires. We did law enforcement. I remember I only lost in all my time as a search and rescue coxswain. I only lost one boat. We were called out. It was a sailboat off of Pearl Harbor. They'd call us, and he was sinking. He actually had noticed that he was sinking until the water came over the engine and sorted it out. We got out there and just came alongside. I just put on my engineering seaman with a P250 drop pump, and they were assembling it and just starting to fire it up when another wave came over it and it sank out from under their feet.
Man, everybody make it off?
Oh, yeah, everyone made it off. I picked them up out of the water, and I had to fill out paperwork on that darn P250 pump for months afterwards. But, yeah.
Tell us about the fires. Where'd you... What kind of fires were you fighting out there?
We fought a fire in Kauai. Actually, it was a sailboat, about 40-foot sailboat, and it had Christmas lights up and a generator on deck running lights, and it had caught fire. And we went over, and we were real fortunate. There was a barrel of gasoline on deck, and what saved us was it was full. But it was there at fire, and the paint started to melt. We got in, and we got every cloth, you know, put water on and put the fire out. And
did you put the fire out before she burned to the water line, or did it make it to the water line?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, all right.
No, we put her out first, and actually we sat out there, and we dewatered her and checked and made sure everything. We were out there for several hours.
That's an important point, Doug, because – any new BM3 listening, always remember when you fight fires on boats, you immediately have to dewater the
right.
boat.
Yeah. Right.
Yes, you immediately dewater, and you have to, you know, and keep in check the well because there can be damage you don't see.
Oh, yeah. It's funny that you mentioned, like, the Christmas lights because Bill and I were just discussing some planning for a lighted boat parade we got coming up. And
it involves generators and Christmas lights.
Hopefully
funny
that
enough.
Doesn't happen. Yeah, I guess we're going to need, like, that gallon gasoline can on
yeah.
there.
Yeah. That's well, use the safety can.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Smart man. What about law enforcement? What were you guys doing out in out there?
We did boating safety patrols.
Were you armed?
We were armed. We actually pursued, and one of the things we got put in the newspaper, we picked up a boat that had been stolen from Alawai Yacht Harbor, and we went and chased him down and took the guy into custody and towed the boat back.
We need more details, Doug.
Yeah, like, this is cool.
Yeah, tell me about it. Listen, I knew this guy had a story. Yeah, let's
are you carrying like a 45 on your hip, or is that the 9mm at this point?
No, the engineer had a shotgun, and we had a M50 on the rail.
Seriously?
Browning
wow.
M50.
You mean business. Yeah, I love it. That's great.
Yeah, the guy was... He was pretty intimidated. He didn't really want to mess with us. We were ready for whatever.
What kind of boat did he steal?
It was a small yard. As I remember, it was under 40 feet, maybe around 35 foot or so. And but again, sorry, this was, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah, no, I got
it. Big enough, I think I have a newspaper article about it somewhere. But, you know, it was just, you know, we did that kind of thing all the time. That was just our job.
All right. Well, I mean, we got to get into details on this one because it's interesting. So are you underway on patrol?
Can I tell you a humorous one?
Absolutely.
Yes.
But for the cops out there, I'll have to say the call that I remember most is as a coxswain, and you might need to edit this out, but we were in the boathouse one day there at Bay Honolulu, and we had the two 378s in, the Mellon and the Jarvis, and I believe a 180, the Buttonwood. And we're just, you know, at work in the boathouse. We heard a bunch of cheering break out. So we went out to see what was going on. And there was a little 36-foot sailboat sailing down the channel with a guy at the helm and two rather beautiful ladies posing naked for all the sailors. Of course, all the ship's work came to a stop, and everyone manned the rails.
At attention.
We immediately got a call from the commanding officer to go out and board that vessel and find them in violation.
Buzzkill.
yeah. So, you know, we did. Well, it was this job. We went out there, and, you know, we tried to be real stern as you can. You know, I was a 19-year-old kid with a couple of naked ladies. And at first glance, I'll have to say that their personal flotation devices were certainly approved by this Coast Guardsman and my crew, but
we're not editing this.
I can't believe that's funny, but it is.
It's
right?
We're all 12.
I know we are.
So yeah, you know, we did the boarding job. I just remember that, but we had a standing invitation. It was an airline pilot and a couple of stewardesses that decided they'd go out and give the sailors a show.
What an 80s story. Like, is this the 80s or is this still so? It's probably the 80s by now. Like, that's so cool. The only thing that would have made it better would have been if it was Tom Selleck. Like,
with the mustache. Yeah. What was the reaction from everybody on the cutters? Were they just like,
everyone lined the rails. They were cheering and clapping. They loved it.
But when you guys had to go out there and board them, were there just boos and cheers?
Yeah, there was some booing, and they weren't real happy.
Yeah,
but
I bet.
Yeah.
That's good. That was a good one.
Yeah, and I'm sure you immediately directed those ladies to get dressed.
Not really.
Well, that's usually the best sea story ever.
That was a pretty good sea story. Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, they were having fun. The sailors had fun. It was one of those moments, you know.
I love it, Doug. That was good.
Yeah.
Man, I want to hear more. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, you know, transitioning out to what you're doing now, but. You got any others from Hano or Kauai?
I remember one. You know, one thing I found out as a search and rescue coxswain is that they'll let just about anyone run a boat. I think they ought to have some licenses. But we had one. It was a sailboat that had come up from Tahiti, and they mistook the tiki torches on the beach of the Ilokai Hotel for the Alawa Yacht Harbor and sailed onto the reef. And we pulled them off, and so it was fortunately fairly calm weather. And like I said, it'd been a long time since the Coast Guard has used tiki torches as aids to navigation. But
right.
you see a little bit of everything in the boaters out there.
You gotta do what you gotta do when you're in the Far East,
right?
I mean, what more can you say? Yeah. What was the biggest seas you saw out there in the 41, Doug?
Oh. God, I don't know now. Maybe 7-8 foot.
Yeah. And could you, did you guys have, like, prohibitions on surf and stuff back then? Like, could you take the 41 out and, you know, could you take it across a breaking bar?
No, well, we didn't have any bars there out in the islands, and that's,
nothing between the reefs or anything?
No.
No.
No, we'd have, you know, there were breaks and came in, but there were regular channels that we had. There was, we didn't work in the surf.
Yeah.
And frankly, we didn't have the boats for it. So that's, you know, one of the things I missed. I wish that I had had the option to try and achieve surfman. My hat is off to those folks. But the cards didn't fall that way. Like, I did get a lot of experience and went a lot of places, so.
I was going to say, and again, yeah, Doug, no one feels bad for you.
No, no, especially not with that last story.
Right. That's good. Well, hey, Doug, so I know after Hano, right, you were released from active duty, served a total of 4 years, 4 months in some of the coolest locations that I've heard, as remote as one of them, at least one of them was.
I was going to say, did you get out after 4 years because you're like, I just can't top this?
Right.
It's over. Can't get better.
I did. I was sent to some beautiful places. I'm pretty isolated, but it opened a whole new world to me.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and you use your GI Bill to go to the California Maritime Academy, start sailing tankers. And I know you told us that you kind of came full circle and came back in a job that was a little aligned with Coast Guard priorities up in Valdez.
That's correct. Yes, I sailed tankers out of the Maritime Academy as third and second officer. I was the third mate on the Glacier Bay when it struck in Cook Inlet in 1987. It was the first major oil spill in Alaska. A very unfortunate circumstance. As I said, I unfortunately was the mate on watch. I did not have the con. The pilot was on the bridge, and we had a local pilot who had the con at the time. But the big result of that was that I saw what they did and didn't have for oil spill response in the state of Alaska. And what they had was pretty skimpy. So I continued sailing on tankers, but then in 2 years later, in 1989, I was a second officer on the Aspen, another tanker, and we had just gone to anchor in Prince William Sound at Knoll's Head 15 minutes before the Exxon Valdez struck by reef. Just terrible, terrible devastation.
Was it pretty much immediate? Did you see, could you tell like it was immediate devastation, or is that more?
It was immediate. It spread a lot, and they didn't do anything really to respond for the first 3 days.
Yeah.
Their barge with equipment was on shore, frozen in, and what they had wasn't much. It was pretty pitiful, is all I'll say about that.
But then you had a hand in kind of turning that around, right, to prevent future incidents?
Yes, I went up. I got up there. I ran various vessels for the cleanup up there, and saw basically the devastation, you know, firsthand and what it's done to Prince William Sound, which is, I'll have to say, is my favorite spot in the whole world.
That's saying a lot, Doug.
Yeah.
Because you've been to some good spots,
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, I was thinking about this earlier. I do still go back to Marcus Island sometimes in my mind. You're just away from the whole, a calm spot, away from the whole world, and
that's what I always say. Like, even boot camp, right, for as terrible as it is, what an awesome,
because it was all you had to do.
You didn't have to do anything, man.
Right.
Yeah, like, here's when you eat. Yep. Here's when you didn't have to think about anything.
Right.
It was all provided for. All you had to do was PT.
Man, like, you had to wash yourself.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, what a great existence, right?
Yeah.
No real problems. Yep. You think you got problems, but you don't.
Right. You got a bunch of manufacturing problems.
Right.
You know, I look at it back now, and frankly, the Coast Guard took a boy out of high school and made a man out of him.
Nice.
That's the quote.
I like it.
Right there.
That's the quote. And the other one.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Doug, tell our audience, so you are another Comanche sailor now. I know that you're Coast Guard Cutter Comanche, homeported up in Seattle, I think, right?
We're homeported in Tacoma, Washington right now at Taiye Marina.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm basically the ship's bosun, though I do a little bit of everything, as we all do. I'm actually, now we've been in need of engineers, so I'm in training on the old Cleveland V-12 locomotive engines from 1942 that power her. We needed engineers, and so I'm doing that. Right now we're restoring a 26-foot motor whale boat that we intend to use as a tender for the Comanche, hauling people back and forth. We work with the Boy Scouts a lot. In fact, we will have Boy Scouts aboard again for 3 days next weekend. We do some work with troubled youth, but mostly we're out. We travel around Puget Sound in the summer to various sports, showing the flag and telling people about the Coast Guard and, you know, and what we've done.
What a cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah, like, I love that you guys do it, man. Yeah. I cannot wait to get out there and visit the Comanche myself.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
The photos and stuff you guys
have. It's a real proud thing, my friends. I take an awful lot of pleasure in it, I'll have to say. It's a proud thing.
Well, I'm proud of you for doing it.
Yeah, for
number
sure.
One. Yeah, yeah. Again,
thank
I can't
you.
Wait to visit. Yeah, can't. Thank you for what you do for the youth and for the service.
Right.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, Doug, I'll give you another opportunity. You got anything else that you want to talk about before we say thank you and let you go?
No, I'd say that's about it. Like I said, I was lucky to travel all over. I meet a lot of people. I'm still in contact with a few of them. Awful proud to have been a Coast Guardsman, and I really enjoy what I do with the Comanche these days. If any Coast Guard vets or active duty in the area would like to come visit us, we'd just love to see them and have a cup of coffee and tell some sea stories.
Can they find you guys online?
Yes, they can. They can find us on Facebook as Tug Comanche.
Okay. Tug Comanche. Cool. So look it up, give it a like, and support where you can. I know they're always looking for donations to try and keep her running.
Sure, it's not free to keep that thing floating.
For sure.
Well, that's exactly right.
Doug, we so much appreciate your time today. We appreciate your stories. We appreciate your service, and we thank you for your service.
Yeah.
And open invite, man. If anything comes back up, you had some good ones. In addition to that,
okay.
That phenomenal career.
Anytime, Doug. Thank you very much for your time today and everything you're doing to keep telling the story of the Coast Guard.
Well, thank you, guys, and I really appreciate the chance to talk with you. And I'm honored to be on here with you today.
Awesome,
thanks again.
Doug. Thank you. Let us know if we can do anything for the Comanche going forward.
I sure will, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, brother. Thanks.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org, that's CoastGuardFoundation.org, to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.